All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get started. Welcome to you all for today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. The National Disability Insurance Scheme, is it meeting its objectives? My name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch. As regular visitors will know, the lectures bring speakers to the library to speak on topics of interest to senators and members and to the work of the Parliament. Today's lecture, of course, is on the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which was established by the Act of that name in 2013 and began to be introduced across Australia from 2016. It creates a managed market for disability services in Australia for Australians under the age of 65 who have a permanent and significant disability. The NDIS website states that as an insurance scheme, the NDIS takes a lifetime approach, investing in people with disability early to improve their outcomes later in life. A couple of years down the track, it seems a good opportunity to examine the extent to which the scheme is achieving its aims and objectives from the perspective of people with disabilities. Our speaker today is Associate Professor Helen Dickinson from the Public Service Research Group at the University of New South Wales, Canberra. Her expertise is in public services, particularly in governance, commissioning and priority setting and decision making. She's published an impressive 16 books, according to her website, and over 50 peer-reviewed journal articles on these topics. She's also co-editor of the Journal of Health Organisation and Management and the Australian Journal of Public Administration. Helen will speak for about 25 to 30 minutes and then we'll have question time as usual. Please join me in welcoming Helen.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be here and see you all. So today I'm going to talk about the National Disability Insurance Scheme, particularly from a consumer perspective. But I guess it's important that I start by noting that I'm not a consumer of NDIS services. The work that I'm going to talk about is some work that we co-produced with a group of people with disability who we brought in to do a research project with us. And so it's their work that I'll be talking about today, and the voices of quite a few of the team will appear as we go through. Ideally, I would have some of the community researchers with me today, as we've tended to do, but they're based in Melbourne, and we couldn't make the trip at this time, so it's just me here, but I can point you in the direction of some video clips and things that do take on the broader team. Before I get into the content of that, I thought I'd just say a little bit about the Public Service Research Group, which is the research group that I direct, which sits at UNSW Canberra over at ADFA. And we're an interdisciplinary group of researchers, so we bring together people from lots of different disciplines and lots of different policy areas with an interest in policy implementation. And so we do a bunch of different research and professional development work, and there's a sense of some of the different themes that the work maps across, and you can see that the NDIS fits quite squarely within most of those, being a great example of large-scale reform, a real sense of diversity, inclusion and equity in it, and thinking about the kind of capabilities and capacities we need within public services to work in these different ways. So the work I'm going to talk about today is one of a number of different projects that we have that look at disability issues, and so I may draw from some other of those as we go through. We have work around disability and health, a linkage project that Jim O'Carey, who's here with us, leads, that's looking at stewardship of markets in the NDIS. We do some work around disability employment service, and we do some comparative work as well with other countries who have individualised systems of disability services. So, as you all will be well aware, the NDIS was introduced with huge kind of, it was really kind of welcomed and with huge promise, and here's some of the detail of what the NDIS scheme was supposed to do. As it says there, it's supposed to support a better life for hundreds of thousands of Australians with a significant permanent disability and their families and carers. And that's a really important commitment in a context where, at the time, we know that the evidence showed that, in terms of outcomes, people with disability performed far poorer than the broader population, and also fared much worse when compared to a number of other OECD countries as well. So the NDIS was introduced with a huge amount of promise for people with disability and their family. And yet, I think there's not much of a day goes by and we don't read something in the media that is a negative account of the NDIS. And I think that's really, it's really challenging, where you've got a kind of really welcome policy reform, but yet every time something comes out, it seems to get slammed within the media. As I say, the research landscape, we kind of had a thought about that and said, well, there's quite a lot of work that we find that looks at provider perspectives around the scheme, and the latest report from National Disability Services came out at the weekend, where they do a lot of surveying of providers. We see quite a bit of work with policymakers, and Gemma's an HMRC-funded fellowship explores the implementation of the NDIS, and she regularly speaks to policymakers and writes about those issues. But we thought, well, where's the consumer voice in some of this? There's a lot of voices from the system, but not necessarily people on the receiving end of that. And there is a component of that in the independent evaluation of the NDIS that Flinders University did, but it's a relatively limited number of interviews and had been released at the time that we were doing this work as well. So we decided we would do a piece of research and we'd take a participatory and collaborative approach. So we wanted to go after the voices of people who receive NDIS services and their families, but we decided to co-produce this with a group of people with disability who didn't necessarily have research experience, but obviously have a lifetime of lived experience of disability and attempting to navigate complex service systems. So we recruited 9 individuals, and they're people who all have a level of disability that would make them eligible for the NDIS when it rolls out into their area, and actually a number of them are transitioning onto the scheme as we speak, and you'll hear from some of those later. And so we did the training session. That's our first day of our training session when everybody got together. That's where they're all looking slightly nervous and not knowing what's going to come. And we did 3 days of training. We developed interview schedules, and then we went out into the field. And we very much, the university researchers took a back seat within the interviews. Community researchers led the interviews, and we then analysed the data together. We checked it out with a community forum down in Geelong to check we'd not misinterpreted findings. And then that's when we'd finished the project, when we went off to present to DPC in Victoria. And we've been all around the place presenting to a number of people about the research. So these were what we wanted to think about in terms of that research. Do people perceive that the NDIS is giving them more choice and more control of their funding as they were promised? Is it making it less complex to access services, and is there more efficient use of funding? And does it promote an equity of access, which were all promises of the scheme when it was announced? And so we spoke to 42 people in total. 25 of those are people with a range of different disabilities, and then the other 17 were family carers. So they were principal carers for either young children who weren't old enough yet to participate in interviews, or in some cases adults with severe cognitive impairments. And you'll be unsurprised that given we had a really wide-ranging sample within there, we had really different experiences of the NDIS. So some people told us it was absolutely fantastic, some people told us it was terrible, and some people sat in the middle somewhere. So it really depended on your individual kind of needs and circumstances as to how you felt about this. But a number of people told us that it was much better. So people reported having larger budgets available to them than they had previously. Often parents of young children who'd not been in a disability scheme before, you know, said they were really surprised about the amazing support that they got for their child in a really difficult time where they'd, you know, discovered that they had a severe impairment and were thinking about what life would hold for them. And the other thing that people talked about a lot was reduction in waiting lists. So people had been hanging around on waiting lists for years and all of a sudden found that they could access services in a much more timely way. But there were some kind of more mixed and negative experiences of those as well. So many people talked about the system being very complex and bureaucratic, so having lots of paperwork and generally being kind of difficult to navigate, not knowing where to access support, not knowing how to work through the scheme, not knowing what different acronyms meant, and generally feeling lost within that. And yesterday, we did this research it's a few months since we did this research, so yesterday I tweeted out to a bunch of people, you know, are the findings still up to date, or have things changed? It's a really rapidly moving kind of context, and so I just wanted to check the degree to which some of these findings still hold. And Piers, who he works at the University of Melbourne, but supports a family member through the NDIS, and his take really well represented the kind of mixed view that we talked about in this, in that the, you know, the assessment processes are often quite opaque. It's not clear what's going to happen, why decisions have been made. That what you get out of that really depends on the care planner that you get, and there's really different ability in terms of those care planners, and that it takes quite a while to get a review of a planner, even if you have a deteriorating conditions, and all of that means it's very uncertain. But as he finishes there, but actually, compared to the previous system, he was saying that he really appreciates the ability to choose a different provider with the funds, or choose a different kind of care, a different individual with those funds, which you couldn't do under the previous scheme. And I don't think you see this picture very well, but this is one of our interviewees who came in, brought in two big folders of paperwork to the interview to show us just what they'd had to do to navigate the scheme and to demonstrate all of that. And a lot of people were very negative about the care planning processes. Lots of turnover of planning staff and people not understanding the nature of disability. And even people being, you know, saying that their own experience was disregarded by the planner, who said that they understood things kind of better. And that's really problematic, as this interviewee says here, if you can't get the planning right, then the scheme isn't going to work. And one of my responses yesterday from another of the researchers on the team, Georgia, who's about to have her planning meeting this week, and obviously she, through the work that we did, understands the scheme really well and does a huge amount of political advocacy around this, but talks about the amount of preparation that she's needing to do and making sure that letters from professionals are in the right sort of NDIS speak, and really talking about being uncertain about what's going to happen. So there's this real sense of anxiety, because what if the plan means that I lose some of the current support or some of the current providers that I have? It talks about kind of difference in planners, and this is from another of the researchers on the project, Dave, who says that he's been talking to people, you know, he talks to a lot of people who say things like planners asking people who've had an amputation if their condition is permanent, or asking somebody with Down syndrome when they acquired Down syndrome, you know, so really basic kind of stuff around disability that people don't understand. I mean, that's not entirely their fault. They don't come from a background in disability mostly, but there's something about kind of training and preparation that's not quite right there yet. Why this is important as well is what a lot of people told us was not feeling like they were trusted. So saying the NDIS doesn't trust me to make decisions about my life and about spending money. And so one of the things that happened at this time, actually it's since changed, and you know, you do need to acknowledge that the NDIA has picked up a whole bunch of kind of issues that people have talked about and have put in means to address those. But at this time, if you wanted to buy a piece of equipment that may have been relatively low price, you had to go and get an assessment by an occupational therapist or a physiotherapist to say that you were eligible for that piece of equipment. So an example we had, one woman who had a neurodegenerative disorder, and needed a kettle tipper to not burn herself when she made a cup of tea. Said, I saw it in Aldi and it was $50, and so I went and said, could I buy it? And they said, well, we need to get you assessed by an occupational therapist. You went to the occupational therapist, and the assessment was $150 for the $50 piece of equipment. And now that has been changed, and there's been a kind of a lower limit put in around equipment, but clearly that's not a... It's not an efficient use of money, but I think the thing that worries me more about that is not the kind of efficiency angle. It's that, you know, less than 10 people with a disability in this country will get individual funding. You need to have a lifelong, permanent and fairly severe disability to get access to the scheme, and you're in it for life. And so if your first interaction with that scheme is being told, we don't trust you to make a decision about a $50 piece of equipment, that's going to change the way that you interact with that scheme over your life. Boundaries of mainstream services is another major issue that has been talked about quite a bit, and the ability to move across different service systems, health, education, housing are some of the primary ones there. Wanting to combine support across those proving a real kind of challenge and a real incentive for different agents to cost shunt across those different groups. So a number of people have been told by mainstream services, well, you're in the NDIS now, that's this $22 billion scheme, they're going to sort you out, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Dave, who I talked about earlier, who I was checking out about whether it's still the same case, emailed me yesterday to say he's had a difficult experience with the NDIS of late, having been having got onto it for a psychosocial disability, and he takes some quite significant medication that have an impact on it, on his health. And in the run-up to seeing the planner to come onto the NDIS, he was told that the planners will see that those issues that you're encountering are due to your medication, so they're due to your disability, so that they would allocate funds for dietitian, exercise, those sorts of things. However, the one that he saw, and this is getting back to the lottery issue again, said that because the issues with his health were a side effect of medication, then they should be dealt through the health system and through his primary care provider. And so, despite the fact that he had this goal of improving his physical health, he couldn't actually access any funding to support him around that. Other people are quite good at playing or understanding systems and knowing how to use them. So another example that came out of our research was a woman with a small child who went to a planning meeting and said, well, we need some help with his fine motor skills. He's going to go to school soon. He needs to be able to write, so we'd like to get some support around that. And the planner said, I'm really sorry, but writing comes under education, so we can't fund that, so you can't have that. And she said, okay then. How about I need some support for his fine motor skills, because he needs to be able to do his buttons on his shirt so he can be independent and dress himself. That's fine. Stick that in the plan. And so she was able to access the services through that, which, you know, is an amusing story in some senses, but really shows you the equity implications of these planning sorts of processes. People who have the ability to understand and navigate and reframe services often have the ability to access them. And you know, real equity issues, and often those abilities come with different socioeconomic factors as well. So in terms of the key message that we came out of research, and you might have seen some of these images as we went through, and we did the community engagement event, we took along a really great cartoonist with us who drew out the kind of key findings from our research in an attempt to help us make them more accessible. As I say, whether you feel you have choice and control really varies depending on your kind of circumstances and where you're at and the degree to which you get support around that. And again, it varies around complexity and efficiency depending on, did you get a good planner, did you manage to have good communication with the scheme. But overall, access to information, service and support is inconsistent, so there are real kind of equity issues here. And if you think decisions that are happening at a state and territory level now in a number of places to defund advocacy services and things like that are also a huge challenge to to those issues, and will, I would imagine, will exacerbate equity issues. And this isn't an Australian issue. We see this in other other systems around the world. So if you look in the English system, there's, you know, there's evidence of these sorts of equity issues within that as well. So there's nothing that isn't kind of unpredictable. And I guess if we look at welfare policy broadly, we see similar sorts of patterns across that. So how we support that is a really important issue. So what do we learn from this? As I said, the report's a few months old, and so I've been reflecting on this for a little while. And I guess one of the things is there's still a lot of goodwill and belief and optimism around the NDIS. People want to make it work and think that it's a really important thing. Although you wouldn't know that if you're researching, you release a report around the NDIS and get a barrage of media requests asking you to confirm that the NDIS is failing and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's a really big scheme that's really difficult to implement. And I think that probably Medicare is probably the example that of the last kind of big reform like this. And the experience of that with Medibank, and then it went came back, and you know, it's been through these situations. And the challenge with it, of course, is it will never be done. The reform will never be done. It will always move forward. And one of the things about the NDIS that interests me is the kind of efficiency angle through it. When the National Health Service was introduced in England after the Second World War, the big argument at the time was that it would be introduced and that would be a really important thing because people were waiting a long time or not accessing health services. And initially it would be expensive as you kind of got people in and you kind of treated those conditions, but over time you would spend less and less money on the health service because people would be cured and would not be living with, would not be living in ill health anymore. And of course, that hasn't happened. The history of the NHS has been it's expanded. And so there are some important kind of efficiency lines that we need to think about in terms of the NDIS and the role of actuaries within these sorts of schemes. And that's some work that Gemma and Ellie and I are doing at the moment. So I think generally people think the change is needed, but one of the real challenges for the NDIS is going to be able to match up the rhetoric of this is going to be great, it's going to be a really fantastic initiative for people with disability and their family, with the reality of what's happening at the moment as a huge kind of reform takes place. The other thing about the reform is it's happening far quicker than it's happened in other places. I mean, we know that from the Productivity Commission's review of costs, where they talked about the need to slow down the scheme. Obviously, some of the speeding up of that was very political, about getting it in place and getting it embedded so that the funding couldn't be removed. But again, if you compare to other countries, and I kind of think to the example of the English system, which is the one that I'm the most familiar with outside the Australian system, and you know, the story there, I mean, it's an unfair comparison in some sense, because we didn't start out saying let's individualise disability funding in this way, but we saw a market created around disability services in the 1980s as local governments went through compulsory competitive tendering, and we saw services move outside of local governments into other entities. In 1996, we saw the first individualised funding mechanism, direct payments, were introduced, and a small number of people took a cash equivalent of their care and purchased from the market. And it was 2013 before everybody assessed as being eligible for social care funding was to be offered a personalised funding. So it's a story of about 40 years of going through this process. And, you know, the speed has been far more rapid within Australia, and I think people are feeling really uncertain about what's happening. And I guess the NDIS work shows that providers have a real issue around capacity to be able to deliver at a tariff rate. So I think it's really important that we bear all of that in mind when we think about whether the NDIS is meeting its objectives or not. The NDIA, to be fair, has addressed a number of the issues that were kind of teething issues. If we think phone plans were introduced because there hadn't been a huge number of people who were on plans initially. I think they got introduced when there were about 30,000 or so people on them. that brought in a huge number more people on plans because you can do it more efficiently on phones, but people were saying that they didn't have a very good experience through that, and so that's been backed away from. There are some pilots around the country where people are seeing a draft of their plan before they get it. So one of the issues at the moment is because people don't see a draft. You see a planner, then the plan turns up, and that's it. And if you want to question anything, you have to go through a review process. And so there is we're piloting seeing plans there. And there's a bunch of other, you know, so the minimum spend around equipment and things like that. Some of those things are being dealt with, and that's a really good sign that some of those teething issues are being addressed. I think one we need to think a lot more around is care planning. As I say, it's a really crucial bit of that process, particularly given the relationship between an individual and a scheme over the long term. And I don't think it's just the NDIS that does this either. I think there are a number of different welfare schemes around the country where we don't sufficiently invest in the individuals who are the gatekeepers and the people who you kind of come to first in these schemes. They tend to be low paid, relatively undertrained, and so I think about employment services is a good kind of comparison here. And their role is actually really important in the scheme. Just because there's a lot of them doesn't mean that they're unimportant. I think we need to think about that with a bit more detail. There's a real question for me over the interface with mainstream services and the lack, the local area coordination function. So again, all of the media attention, all of the discussion we seem to have is this less than 10% of people who are going to be on individualised funding. That leaves 90% of Australians with a disability out there. If we know that people who are on individualised funding are being told you can't access mainstream services, that's presumably an experience for at least some of that rest of that 90%. And if it's going to fulfil the aims, then we really need to think about that function and how it operates and how we can think about a broader notion of inclusion. I mean, you look around the media and people with disability are largely kind of systematically excluded from that. We look at our you've got politicians, and you can probably name a very small number of people who have a known disability, and so how we think about that inclusion issue is really important, and a lot of that is wrapped up in this function. And it's finally the saddest thing for me in the research that we did, and I don't know if this has changed, and some people have said that it's got more acute, but the kind of last question that our community researchers asked when we did the research was, if you had the minister responsible for the NDIS who is sat in front of you now, what would you like to say to them about the scheme? And in 99% of the time, people said, I'd just like to say I would like you to listen to people with disability more often. You know, we have this whole scheme that was developed in our name and we're supposed to have this sort of stuff, but we really don't feel like we have a voice and that we have an ability to influence. And I think that's a really... it's a really important factor that we need to bear in mind when we think about the future of the scheme. So, you know, there are real strengths and weaknesses of it, but given that it's such a massive, you know, in some sense it's such a massive reform, the fact that it's there at all is a huge achievement. I guess the question now is how we can keep that momentum and not kind of have people become exhausted by this all and the constant kind of media barrage every time something negative happens, calling and saying, well, the NDIS has clearly failed. So I'll stop then, but very happy to take questions.
Colleagues, any questions?
Thanks for that. That's fabulous. I'm just wondering if you've had any participants or if you've come across people in other research who have had any experience with the interface with aged care, either that they're too old with NDIS or maybe younger people in residential aged care trying to access other services or get out.
It's a really interesting area, and I know there's a real lack of kind of thought around this at the moment. So I know there's... somebody's trying to put together a book, which you two probably have a chapter in the moment, I do, and they want somebody to talk about the NDIS and aged care interface, and they can't find anybody to do that. I think there's a lot of confusion, so the fact that you can kind of enter before you're 65, but you know you need to kind of stay in it then, but you can't enter after. It's really confusing, and people often kind of don't understand that distinction. And obviously, kind of younger people in care homes is a really significant issue, and there are a bunch of National Alliance for Young People in Care Homes. There's some really good work around this, but I've got some really horror stories about, you know, people transitioning onto the NDIS and then not having feeding tubes and things like that that were previously provided by health agencies not being provided, and saying, well, you know, that's nothing to do with this anymore, you're on the NDIS. So I think really significant issues there. Yeah.
There's been a between 3% and 5% reduction in young people in aged care homes since the NDIS came in, so it's pretty minimal in terms of its impact so far.
But the challenge there is often is as well, because people have such huge complex issues that, and they need nursing care around the clock, that and they're in areas where there's nothing else that's suitable in terms of where somebody, you know, could live. So, I mean, that's a huge issue. I mean, you know, for some people it may work, but that's not going to be the case for everything. And I guess there's an issue around, and this is the kind of project that we have at the moment around market stewardship of, you know, there is a sense in the kind of a lot of the documentation around the market in disability services of the, it's a technical term, but the Kevin Costner School of Market Management, which is, you know, in the field of dreams, they kind of say, you know, you build the baseball thing and they come. And there's a sense of that in some of this stuff with markets. A lot of public service markets are, well, if we just have some money and say we want to have some markets, then people will come and play here. And the reality is they're not. And I think for young people who are in those sorts of facilities, that's very much a situation that they're within. There is nothing else for them to go into that will provide that. But yet, because the nature of their needs are so significant, the investment you would need to put in something to support that, and then the kind of impacts of the tariff for different services probably not being right for everything, is a bit of a challenge. And we've seen, you know, and that has been around the high-level needs for a lot of groups. I mean, we saw in the ACT in Victoria a number of providers who, for services for young people with significant cognitive impairments or personality disorders, providers who provided really amazing kind of developmental services for years, saying we're going to pull out of this, we can't afford to do this anymore. So I think there is some pricing that's not quite right in a few places. That's certainly the findings of the NDS survey that came up recently.
Thank you very much. Did you see any difference in your research between people who live in cities and metropolitan areas as opposed to sort of rural and remote areas?
A little bit, but not huge. The research we did was in Barwon, and so we spoke to people in Geelong and then out as far as Colac and things like that. And it's interesting because they're saying the linkage around thin markets, that's a project that we're doing in partnership with DSS and NDS. And I think it's probably fair to say that some of their concerns around, or at the start of the project, around thin markets were around rural and remote areas being particularly kind of bad examples of where you would have this. And I kind of have some sympathy with that view, but to some extent, people who live in those areas kind of relatively, they live there for a relatively, you know, a relative period of time, know people around, and are quite used to having kind of thin markets to some extent, and can sometimes come up with some really creative ways of dealing with things. I think the bit we haven't thought about in terms of thin markets enough is in the kind of big metro areas where you may have loads of providers and they're all terrible, or they don't offer what people want, and this is some of the work that we're doing at the moment. One of the big challenges, though, around that was around travel time for professionals. So if you're getting if a physio or a speech therapist is coming out to you, their travel time was included in your budget. So if it took them an hour to get to you, then you would have an hour less in terms of time. And so in iterations of plans, people were able to argue for more of that, but I think that's not been entirely kind of dealt with at the moment. So lots of complexities, but more nuanced than I think the way we sometimes think about markets.
Good.
Yeah,
thanks very much for the presentation. Do you have any comments on the experience of Indigenous people?
I don't, and we say in our report. One of our community researchers is identifies as Indigenous, and she was really clear in encouraging us to say that was a big gap in terms of our work and in terms of all of the other research that I've seen as well, and a fairly significant gap in terms of the scheme. I think in terms if you look at the proportions of Indigenous and people from cold backgrounds who've entered the scheme, they're far lower than we would imagine it would be from the population predictions, and I think it's a real equity issue that we need to do some serious work around. I mean, I know that there's in the Flinders evaluation that they did, the independent evaluation, I know that they looked at an area in Darwin that they write about fairly extensively there, but apart from that, I don't think there's a lot of we don't know enough.
That's it. In terms of the overall promise of the NDIS around choice and control and self-determination, were you hearing from people that the scheme is sufficiently open to be shaped by their choices about how they participate and how are you hearing about barriers to that?
Yeah, I think it's relatively limited. And I mean, for me, if you go and look on the kind of case studies of success on the NDIA website, they're fairly depressing. I mean, it shows you how kind of, what sort of, the parlous states of disability services prior to the NDIS, if, you know, somebody having a wheelchair that works or is an example of success around that. And I think some of the way the planning process happens, that because everything is tied into a line item, and I mean there's more movement than there used to be, but because things are tied into line items, they're tied into activities in defined ways, so they're not really open to being used in different and innovative ways. And so, and I guess if you look, and I think there are real issues in equating giving somebody a financial delegation with either choice or the ability to being innovative, because I think if you look in some other systems that probably have slightly more innovative approaches, they don't necessarily delegate the financial, a particular budget, but what they do is they work really hard around care management. So if you think about the Norwegian scheme and how they do personalisation, it's not about saying this is your financial entitlement, it's saying let's get a really skilled care manager to work with you and plan what you want your life to look like. The greatest examples of innovation we see in the English scheme are where people thought really, really differently about how they use budgets. And they got some kind of, some of those got really positive results. Obviously, there are equity issues in ability to do this. There are also political issues in being able to stand up to those things. So, you know, I think we often are, we seem bizarrely kind of willing to go on spending money on things that we know that don't work and don't have a very good evidence base, and people's experience of them is not positive. But if you try to shift that money into something else that looks like it might be fun or nice, people get a bit kind of, you know, worried about that. It's the kind of, you know, people in public housing having flat screen TV kind of thing that, you know, that seems completely aberrant. You know, you should be far more poor and having a worse time of it than that. I think there's a bit of that around disability services. I remember not long after the NDIS was launched, I went on a radio show, and they said, I can completely see you, I'm completely on board with somebody spending care funding on seeing a sex worker, but you suggested that somebody might be able to go on a holiday, and that's just, you know, beyond the pale that we might be spending kind of public money sending somebody away for a holiday, when, you know, it was an example we'd taken where if you have no access to respite services and there's nothing appropriate in a local area, taking somebody away from that to another area where you might have that. And they said, that looks like a holiday. And the idea that you're paying for that through public funds when I work and I can't afford a holiday is a terrible thing. So I think we've got some way before we can get to some of those really different innovative things. And I think the NDIA has a role there in showcasing some of that, not just, you know, a new wheelchair or, you know, some other kind of device around the house.
Can you talk about the difference between the English system and its personal budgets versus the way we have line items here? Because I think that really sort of elaborates Luke's point about why people can't innovate as much in our system.
Yeah, I mean, in both systems you're supposed to start from outcomes, and we kind of do in planning processes here, but activities are, in the English system, basically you kind of fund activity systems where you're clear about how they're going to lead to particular kind of outcomes. So, for example, I mean, an example that gets used quite a lot is there's a guy who was in his like mid-30s, mental health issues, really socially isolated, and under the previous scheme had been sent 2 days a week to a daycare service where like the average age was 88, and he didn't feel very included in that and what have you. And so they took the money that they would have spent on that and they bought a season ticket to the soccer for him and for one of his friends, and his friend in return for having this said, well, I'll take you there, because he had some anxiety issues and would have gone on his own, I'll take you there, I'll drive you there, and I'll take you to the pub for a beer afterwards with some of the guys, and report far better kind of outcomes for about the same cost that is spent on daycare services. But that's a really difficult thing in some places to defend, where you've got people working minimum wage jobs who say, well, I can't afford a season ticket to the football. If they support my club, they would, because they're terrible. But, you know, you support one of the big clubs, and that's a real challenge, and so to defend some of that. But so every activity is linked into an outcome, rather than having a set of outcomes and then saying, let's define a set of kind of line items that relate to those outcomes. And it's very difficult to move some of those line items around in the NDIS, particularly around things like therapies. So, you know, we were talking to a woman of a young child recently who was having issues in swallowing, and so he'd got some, been given some support by a dietitian. And the dietitian said, actually, you know, after a couple of meetings, said, I'm not sure I'm the best person to do this. Actually, I think what you need to do is see a speech and language therapist. And they had to go for a full plan review. They couldn't just move the line item across. So there's not a huge amount of flexibility there.
Any final questions? Yes, the supplementary question.
Sorry, I was just wondering, when it comes to medical treatments and some other things that people might need, is there any requirement for that to be evidence-based, you know, evidence-based treatments? Like, is it appropriate to go and see a spiritual healer or a naturopath, or what's the scope?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're talking about health stuff, obviously that should come under health, and you know, so I don't think there's much in the kind of listings around those sorts of things for us to get funded under Medicare. You may be able to make an argument for some of those other things in terms of disability, but I, you know, haven't seen any examples of those. What you often need to have is. And Georgia talks about this in her tweet about getting ready for these sorts of things, is, you know, you need to have a letter and possibly more from a range of different medical professionals who lay out what your disability is and the ways that it impacts on your everyday life, and sometimes suggest some of the kind of supports that you might need around that. And then for additional services, you're often assessed by you know, occupational therapists and physiotherapists and psychologists and things like that. So your assessments are often done in that space that are looking in a traditional kind of hierarchy of evidence. So I would be surprised, but you know, that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And you know, to some extent, and a lot of doctors will tell you this, if you go and see somebody like that and it even has a placebo effect and makes you feel more confident, you know, better and more included, then is that a terrible thing? And I think there's a really interesting debate in the medical literature at the moment about interventions that may not have a kind of randomised controlled trial clinical kind of basis for them, but do lead to particular sorts of outcomes for people. So I think it's a more general discussion we may need to have.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I was just going to ask if there was a change you could suggest that would, structural or otherwise, that would improve the NDIS's ability to meet its objectives.
Yeah.
What would that be?
I think really think about care planners in a different sort of way. I think they play such a crucial role in that system and in interacting with individuals and, you know, having an understanding of disability and the way the system is structured at the moment, and because there are concerns about costs, it is, I think, some of the messages you are defending this system from kind of going bankrupt, and you need to defend, and some of the kind of fraud claims and things that have come out recently have not helped that. But I think that, to me, that frontline bit, I think starting there is really important.
Is it training or funding or what?
I think it's training, status. One of the, and I know why this is, you know, because the NDIS is such a hot political potato at the moment. You know, people are using it to kick each other kind of left, right and centre, and I think there's, the NDIA can lurch a little bit from time to time in terms of the stuff, and I think that's unsteadying for some of those care planners as well. So things change quite quickly, and they need to find out other things. So I think better training coming in, having people who have understanding of disability, you know, the idea that, you know, you would have somebody asking if your amputation is permanent, or, you know, another person who we spoke to in our research who's in her mid-30s and had was severe autism and had been basically got barred from the NDIS locally for behavioural problems. You know, that to me is that, you know, autism and behavioural problems are obviously something that are fairly closely kind of connected. So the fact that we've got these decisions that's happening now, people with no experience of disability. And again, that links to the kind of point I finished on around a complete devaluing of the perspectives of people and the voices of people with disability. They know what they're talking about, you know. They navigate these systems and understand them better than we do. All of the time, and yet we don't listen to them around this sort of stuff, and I think that's really important.
I think we have time for a last question.
I was wondering, so one of the areas of criticism has been, particularly for people with psychosocial disability, that language of permanence and not capturing the episodic nature of their disability. And then there are other types of disabilities. Some will be stable, some will be degenerative. How do you think the NDIS can cope with that? Do you think it does cope with that?
No, not at the moment, no. And again, and that sort of linked to that point about understanding of kind of disability as well. And you're right, you know, there's, if you have MS or something like that, you might find that you're relatively well when you're going through your care planning process, and then you dip later on. And I think there's a real challenge around kind of review in the context of people rapidly deteriorating. And I think, you know, the psychosocial stuff is really problematic at the moment. The kind of some of the stories of, and some of that's because you've got multiple systems being reformed at once, haven't you? And is a real challenge around that. But I don't think it accounts for it well at the moment. And that's one of the things that I think kind of better understanding and better investing in those clinic planning processes may do. I mean, why you don't kind of have planners who specialise in psychosocial disability, or planners who might specialise around intellectual disability and stuff. And obviously, again, that's not without its challenges, because, you know, the metro area, then you may be able to find somebody who can do that. You've got rural, remote, and you may have a different kind of issue again. But you could at least go through a planning process and then have a plan checked off by another planner who has the experience in that sort of area. And I think that might help some of those issues. You're right, it's not accommodated really well at the moment.
Right, we should probably wind it up there. Helen, thank you very much. That was very, very interesting. Great research.
Thank you.
Please join me in thanking you. That's an interesting approach to the research.
Yeah.